Today we start a worship series, Messages from the Wilderness, where we are going to encounter different people in the Bible who either their story was located in the actual Judean wilderness, or they are going through a period of adversity that is a wilderness-like experience. So as we get settled in, it's fitting that we kind of spend some time thinking a little bit about our own experience of wilderness. In Minnesota, we tend to love the wilderness, and we think about it more like the Great North Woods, right? And people love their cabin time, and often we find ways to bring our modern creature comforts with us so that we get a chance to enjoy all of the great outdoors with none of the hardships, right? You kind of, you make sure, it's kind of more like going to the zoo, you know? You've kind of set up a nice little parameter and you enjoy things. But in all seriousness, when we get a chance to get out into nature, people often say things like, I feel closest to God when I'm out in nature. And they genuinely have those kind of unforced experiences where there's just something so central to their soul and their nature that everything kind of feels right with the world. And whether or not you're much of a nature person or not, we all have kind of our different experiences and images of wilderness, and we're going to play around with that a lot. For me in particular, something that I wanted to bring up as we start talking about the wilderness is that when I was in college, I spent a lot of my summers working at a church camp. And so when I was doing church camp work, I had a cabin that had some, you know, modest electrical outlets, but nothing else other than those old-fashioned flaps that, you know, you raise to try and pretend like you have some airflow. And your towels are wet for the whole summer, you know, like one of those kind of cabins. And this was still in the era where we didn't have cell phones and all of those things. And so when students showed up for camp, they kind of looked incredulous as to why would I spend my whole summer without TV or McDonald's? Because that, you know, that was still in that era. Now it would have a different list of things. And it would happen like clockwork. Every single Sunday when campers came, you know, the kids kind of looked like, what did mom and dad do to me? You know, I am not going to make it. And then, of course, usually at about a 90% success rate, you know, by Thursday, the kids were crying that they were going to have to leave, and they, you know, they never wanted to leave this perfect paradise, and they were just, oh my goodness, life was so fantastic here at camp. And, you know, by then, as the counselor, I was secretly like, no, you need to go home now, because I'm pretty, I love you, please go home so I can sleep. But, you know, we would go through that cycle. And in college, that was just the case of kind of students who usually had some kind of outdoor experience, but camp was just an extension of maybe experiencing life without technology for a longer period of time, doing something other than that what they were experiencing, and they had a chance to experience the fullness of God in new ways. When I was in seminary, I'd spent some time in my summers working at a different church camp, and this one was in New Jersey. A significant number of students who had come to camp who were from mostly like Newark, New Jersey, or Camden, and had never been outside more than a couple blocks away from their home. And this camp was even more rustic than the previous camp. So this was one of those camps where it was the platform tents, and you had to explain to the kids, please don't even leave your toothpaste in here because the bears will get it. And they really did look wide-eyed and think, what have mom and dad done to me? You know, and that was also a different adventure. And definitely for all of us collectively, we went through, you know, a lot of adversity because this was very different than their ordinary daily life, especially in very high-populated urban environments. But again, there was usually those points of ups and downs where they had an opportunity to experience a part of themselves that maybe they hadn't encountered before, or get a glimpse into different ways of living in the world, or whatever it might be. And, you know, you kind of go on with that camp experience. So sometimes for us, when we think about wilderness, you may not have spent as much time working at camps as I have, but I have that kind of experience about wilderness life, and kind of a little bit more of why, as Christians, sometimes we choose to go out to camp for retreats or for experience, because we're hoping to go into the wilderness, into the chaos, and experience God in a different way. And we set up these ways for us to do it. In our Christian tradition, we've been having things more than just retreat centers for a while, or camp meetings, or whatever the version of it was. A lot of this desire to go out into the wilderness to experience God can be rooted and traced actually through some of the earlier Christian developments in 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. Once Christianity started taking hold, there was this group called the Early Desert Fathers and Mothers, and they were people who were very rigorous in their spiritual disciplines, who would purposely go out into the wilderness. And their wilderness did not look anything like Minnesota. It looked like much more like an arid desert. And they felt like that kind of movement into the desert would allow them to not only experience God in a new way, but they were very specific. They took on 3 renunciations. First is that they actually got rid of all their stuff. So this wasn't just a temporary week in the woods. They would get rid of all their stuff, and they moved into the wilderness with very little. And they renounced their stuff, and then they also worked on renouncing their thoughts. And that's a different sermon thing. But they would talk about how I am not my thoughts. You know, there's something more to me than all these little things that go in and out of my brain. And they would take a 3rd renunciation, which was even to renounce what I would say is their understandings of God, recognizing that God was a lot bigger than maybe their preconceptions of who God was. And they were willing to let all of that go because the intent was to experience God in the fullness of God. And so those early Christian desert fathers and mothers committed their life to doing that, and people would go then into the wilderness to talk with a desert father or mother, one of those little hermits, to get words of wisdom, because there was this understanding that by going out into this space and making such a radical commitment that God could and would show up in a new way, and that there might be something valuable for us all to learn. Now, of course, those Christian desert fathers and mothers didn't just come up with that idea on their own. There's a biblical tradition that they gained from that, an aesthetical movement that you can see if you trace things through the Bible. Of course, we have Jesus going into the wilderness. Anyone remember any stories about Jesus in the wilderness and the temptations that he faced, right? And the fasting, that was a purposeful period in his life where there was trying to be a sense of getting ready for his ministry and a sense of recognizing that in the adversity, there might be some kind of purifying work that he would encounter. And then Jesus didn't make that up himself. We have the stories of John the Baptist, we have the prophets, and then of course we have probably one of the biggest stories about people in the wilderness are those poor Israelites that we talked about last fall in Exodus, who spent 40 years in that wilderness. Because in that wilderness space, that period of disruption, they were learning how to be a new people together, and it took them 40 years. And you could argue whether or not it really even stuck after 40 years. That's for a different space. But we have the Bible speak repeatedly about these wilderness spaces. And what's interesting about our scriptures and the ways they even connect to how we have these feelings of like, I just like going into the wilderness because I feel like I can experience God in new ways, is that throughout the scriptures, the Bible does talk about how when we go into the wilderness, yes, we can experience God in fuller ways. And don't be surprised if it isn't also coupled with incredible adversity and deconstruction and disruption and disorientation and all those other things that come with encountering the fullness of God. So today, as we talk about journeying into the wilderness and how God meets us in those places of adversity in our life, I want to start with the story of Joseph. And the reason that we're starting with Joseph is because, not just because he's in Genesis, I mean, that does help. This is in the first book of the Bible. But because as we follow our biblical stories and we talk about encountering God in the wilderness, Joseph's story speaks, he does go into places of the wilderness through his story, but also speaks about the adversity that he experiences through his narrative, as well as what happens when it's all started with a vision and a dream. And I'm going to really bank and hope on the fact that since you came here on the 4th of July holiday weekend, you might have opened your Bible before, because usually people who come on holiday weekends have studied the Bible a little bit. So please bear with me if I'm just going to skip over a lot of intro Bible stuff. But the story of Joseph is in the first book of the Bible. And Joseph's story starts with what we heard today, where Pam and Chuck were talking about this young man who is only, did any of you catch how old he was in this story? He was 17. I love this. Good job. You're always there for me, Bill. All right, he's only 17. So that's a little detail, but kind of important, right? You have to imagine a young man who, of course, in this story, we say is known as the father's favorite, and all his brothers are older. And they really don't like Joseph. There's nothing they like about him in this story, right? And for Joseph, you also get the sense that he kind of knows that he's loved the most, and he's also not necessarily the most noble of the kids at this point in his life either. To put it kind of mildly, he's not really the typical hero you think of. But Joseph, in this story, in the start, because he's going to take quite a hero's journey, he starts his experiences with a dream. And this is why I bring up his story, is because sometimes when we go through our wilderness experiences, or what brings us into the wilderness, is because God puts a dream into our hearts and our minds. And for Joseph, this was his actual dream. He has two dreams. It says in verse 5 or 6, listen to this dream I had. When we were binding stalks of grain in the field, my stalk got up and stood upright, while your stalks gathered around it and bowed down to my stalk. And then he has a second dream, and it says, I've just dreamed again, and this time the sun and the moon and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. So we have in Joseph's story this young man who has these two dreams that are placed in his heart by God, and they're not really often like the dreams that we attribute, where someone says, "I imagined that I was at the store, and then I met my, you know, brother so and so." It's not that kind of dream. It's an image, right? God places some kind of image on his heart, and what I think is important here is that it's very clear, because these images, if you were to follow the whole Joseph cycle, this does come true, what these dreams are predicting. But of course, in Joseph's experience, he has no idea how this is going to come true or what it really means. There is not certainty, and there's definitely no strategic plan. And that is one of probably the most unsettling parts as we think about these journeys that we take, is often God puts into our hearts, our minds, our dreams, some kind of very deep, profound image that is hard for us to explain or name or strategize, but we have to share it. and something's going to happen, and we don't know what it is. And for Joseph, that's where all of this stuff begins, with a dream, two dreams. But as we learn from this first little narrative, those don't really help his case, do they? No. In fact, it says, if I were to have read the first part right before I said that dream, it said, Joseph dreams of, he has, not only does it not always make a whole lot of sense, but it sometimes can be very disruptive, dangerous, and threatening to those around us. It's not always received with a parade and a banner and saying, I'm so glad you finally, you know, had this vision and now our lives can just be perfect. In fact, a lot of times when people have dreams in the Bible, they don't want to tell a soul because it kind of shakes them to the core and keeps them up at night. But Joseph, he's a little too young to know how dangerous those dreams are. He just kind of spouts it out. And we have that sense then with these dreams that he has, that this is actually what kind of culminates in having him kicked out into what we'd call these wilderness experiences. He has these dreams that God has placed in his heart. He doesn't know what to do with it. His family doesn't like it. And long story longer, he is put through a cycle through Genesis that if you haven't read before, be sure to read Genesis 37 through 50. You'll get to read all the juicy details. But he goes through these adverse experiences, time and trial again, where you can see in his experiences of being near death, being enslaved, being put in prison, I mean, just thing after thing after thing, that Joseph, in each and every trial and adversity, unjust situation, uses those opportunities as moments of sanctification, of transformation, and grace. Joseph doesn't become a victim in this story. He becomes a hero, even though he starts off as a brat. And we can have a lot of conversations about how fair his situations were or not, but the point is that through that encounter of each of those adversities, you can get the sense and the understanding that over time, God is partnering with Joseph to help him become wise, to help him become faithful, to help him become then that person that will lead and provide a way forward. And we find that in the midst of all of the struggles and the mistakes, that he becomes an embodiment of that dream that made no sense from the beginning. But there wasn't a straight, easy path. It went through a lot of wilderness. And this is where we start as we go forward in our lessons from the wilderness this summer. We are going to encounter a lot of people in the Bible who go through a lot of tough stuff. And we are given the choice to decide whether or not we are going to use those adversities as moments of transformation and sanctification in our lives and let God lead us through. And so today, as we take these, as we think about Joseph and the start and the blessings of the wilderness, I want to remind and encourage you that in your own lives, when God speaks to you and puts a dream in your heart, do not be afraid if it is unclear. Do not be afraid if it creates disruption. Do not be discouraged when you make mistakes. Because if you are willing to go forward with God, to be faithful to the voice to the one who puts that dream in your heart, you will find over time that God will provide you with the grace to become that dream, and that your life will be transformed about how. And so, let us not be afraid. Let us not worry when others hate us. But let us look first and foremost to God and to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. Amen.